Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I've got the lurgy.
Do you?
Indeterminate lurgy.
Say more British things. That's wild. Indeterminate lurgy.
Lurgy, yeah. You job lurgy?
Like lethargy?
No, lurgy. It's like you're, oh, I've got lurgy. Just like it's, you're full of stuff. Lurgy.
That's, you can put that one right up there with the big light. These are ones that are
oh my god,
so far out of light. Americanisms.
Will somebody get us another drink?
Welcome to Jim and Tommy's Musical Theater Happy Hour. I'm Tommy.
And I'm Jimmy, and this is the only musical theater podcast with Bud Lights
and opening nights. Here, we take apart your favorite shows, muddle them together with a shot of buffoonery, and pour you a refreshing glass of musical theater conversation. Jimmy, what you drinking today?
Lamb sip.
Not a bit of port?
No. Do you have lamb sip in the States?
No, but I could guess.
That's great.
Is it, we have emergency. Do you have that?
I think it's like airborne.
Yeah, yeah, same
like
sort of
dissolvable, yeah.
Vitamin C shit.
Yeah, and it's got paracetamol in it.
Yeah.
So
oh,
it's
yours?
British, therefore it counts.
Ours
is medicated.
Yeah, ours is not medicated.
420.
This is gonna be a wild episode.
Oh dear. I'm sorry.
Read the quiz question.
Okay. Ooh. The author of this musical that we are talking about today allegedly likes pina coladas and getting caught in the rain, a fact which I think has haunted him his entire career. Tommy, what show did this author create?
I gotta find a gavel. The Mystery of Edwin Drood.
Judge's creature of a race by each feature in his face. Just look at him, I rest my case, well, there you are.
There you are!
And it matters not to me what part of town you come from. We but cheer you've made it here at all.
Hip, hip,
here within this garish parish called the Music Hall.
There you are!
How very glad we are that
there you are!
It isn't who you are, but
where you are!
That doesn't get annoying. Well, I've seen this done amateurly.
Yeah.
And I actually think some people who were in that listened to this. But hey, that got annoying.
I could see. I was telling my boyfriend this. I think this is a show that is fun to watch and much more fun to be in than it is to watch.
100%. I would love to be in the show.
I'd be a great chairman.
Yeah, actually, you would.
But I do think Like, I could see... I once saw a terrible high school production of Noises Off.
Oh, God.
Which I found so much funnier than a good production.
Oh, really?
Like, oh, man. And only because I knew the show really well. But, like, watching the things not go wrong that are supposed to go wrong.
Actually, yeah, there's something special about that.
It's a really, really special kind of comedy.
That's quite unique to Noises Off, I guess.
Yeah. But I could see being trapped in an overindulgent. Well, I don't know. Could this show be too indulgent?
No, because it's very is self-effacing the right word? Is that the one where you like make fun of yourself?
Sure,
is that what that means
make fun of yourself.
Let's
sure,
go, let's go with that. But it does that all the way through. So I don't think it can be. Yeah, self. It'd be very. I don't know. It'd be very weird.
Yeah,
if that was the result. But it can also just be a lot.
Yeah, it can be a lot.
You know
to
what I mean?
In.
If it's very, you know, if everyone is being melodramatic,
absolutely,
that's a lot.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I do wonder if the show would swing in Denver, because it does take a lot of like theatrical understanding. You know.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Right, and just because I find that Denver isn't quite as much of a theater going city as say Chicago is, or New York or London or something like that. And like it might, you know, some of the comedy might not just land. I don't know.
I think, yeah, maybe some of like the stage jokes, but I think the general, we've not even talked about what the hell it is yet, Tommy. the general, I would say it's very accessible.
That's true.
Because it's silly.
Yeah, it's
in
silly.
The same way that I think anyone could see Noises Off and think it's the funniest thing that's ever existed.
That's true. A lot of, I forget that so much of it is just, you know, firmly sat in low humor, falling downstairs, slapsticky sort of body stuff, which is always funny.
It's a treat. Anyway, hey, what is it?
Mystery of Edwin Drood, music, lyric, books, and orchestration by Rupert Holmes. More than a hat trick.
I wonder, like, because we say this a lot, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't think this has ever happened before. And then 9,000 people tell us the very long list of people that do that.
Yeah.
But, like...
I found a write-up somewhere that said, often Rupert Holmes is quoted as being at least the first, if not the only, to do all four. And this particular write-up said, as far as anyone can really tell in modern musical theater, that seems pretty true. But if you do look back to perhaps some of these music hall style things or early vaudeville stuff, that sort of thing was very common. In the same way that like Shakespeare wrote and starred in his play. Like pre-diversificating theater jobs. But for 1985, this is a huge deal.
Right.
A huge undertaking.
Absolutely. Who did Comet's orchestrations? Oh, he did.
Yeah. I do think there's more contemporary examples. I think we're seeing, you know, in new modern musical theater post 2010, maybe.
Yeah.
We see more of like single author vision. But it is, you know, it is interesting to...
It's impressive.
Yeah. Well, and we talk so much about, like, there is this, in the romanticized musical theater ideal, there's supposed to be this authorial tension, and you want collaborators. Sondi talks about this. Like, you want people to pull you in the different directions and to tell you your ideas are stupid. And so I do, you know, to be able to do it successfully, I think both takes a deep understanding of your own hubris and a willingness to, like, talk yourself out of stuff.
Yeah, I think so. But it's interesting because, like, a lot of people who have done all three or four, the shows are very good.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But maybe that's just they're very good because this person is very good at it.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
I do.
Like, I can't think of an example of a bad one.
Well, I
so
do.
So maybe it's just a...
I do also wonder, like, a lot of the triple threats, it's only one show. Even like Meredith Wilson, who arguably has other shows, but like one successful show. And I often wonder if it has more to do with the success of the idea and less to do with the, like, you have a good idea that, you know, arrives in your head almost fully formed, and all you have to do is translate it onto paper and flesh it out. Whereas, like, you see people who are serial writers, you know, bounce between collaborators or have tried and true collaborators because that becomes their process. And then, you know, they find different successes that way. It's an interesting you know, because our art form's so collaborative.
Exactly.
Put it in the back of your mind, playwrights, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Try it. Yeah. Learn. Hey, this was performed in 1985.
Yeah, it got its premiere at Shakespeare in the Park in Central Park and transferred to Broadway in 85. Yep. Won a ton of Tony Awards.
Did.
Nominated.
I mean,
for...
he won a ton of Tony Awards.
Yeah.
He was just told, you're very good.
You're very good. You're very good. Then made it to the West End 87, a tour in 88, directed by Rob Marshall, surprisingly.
Yeah.
Two West End revivals, 07 and 12, and then the 2012 West End revival transferred to Broadway, basically.
Yes. And I saw it.
Yeah? Did you like it?
Yeah. It was that my first Broadway? No, it was my second Broadway show.
You saw it here. You saw it in New York.
I saw it in New York. New York. My first Broadway show was Peter and the Starcatcher.
Okay.
And then I saw this. This is my first Broadway musical. Give it that.
What a great first show for you on Broadway.
Yeah, as well at the time, I didn't really know it beyond listening to it for the Tonys.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I barely knew it, and it was a great time. And I will talk all about my experience later.
Excellent.
When we get into Stephanie Duplock. Which would be a full segment.
Yeah, we're actually starting a spin-off podcast, the Block Cast.
Stephanie J Talk.
Ooh.
That works.
TM, TM, TM. Copyright.
It's ours.
Sorry, Steph.
I mean, with the amount of podcasts that exist nowadays, I wouldn't be surprised. Hey. Well, we've already talked quite a lot about it, but should we start doing it properly?
Sure. Here we go.
I fear the night disguises you. Bright eyes will burn me, blinding me. Oh, my, to me undressed and is all revealing. English child, near English child. Each one of us will sometime wait to meet with love and never know its name. His name, but in the moonfall soon appears of you. So that soon I only
So, yeah, I think, like, I do just want to, like, give him a little bit of an applause, because I'm just very impressed, because I personally think it's real solid.
Oh, yes.
Like, it's really, really solid.
Yeah.
In terms of a really entertaining night out at the theater.
Even just technically, like, I think you dive into the lyrics of some of these songs, and it takes as many listens as, you know, perhaps something like Hamilton does, just because it's so dense in some of its wordplay and, you
Absolutely.
Know, creativity and metaphor. Rupert Holmes knows what's up when it comes to songwriting, I think.
He really, really does. I mean, obviously, that's how he started off. And a lot of the pop songs that he wrote are quite narrative, do you know what I mean? Which was obviously quite a trait. In the 70s, you know, I mean, these songs did get quite expansive and sort of ballady in terms of the traditional, idea of a ballad.
Right.
And so you could tell he had the skills. And apparently, according to many interviews, he had always kind of wanted to do musical theatre, but never really thought of it as an option.
Sure, yeah.
It was this show in particular that he had in his head, is like, this would make a good musical, just because, you know, the main character is very musical. The people sing songs in the book, and that is always a good sign of something that can translate quite naturally onto a stage.
Well, and that he you know, kind of, I mean, stumbled into is the wrong word because it's very intentional, but found this like very apt, productive framing device around the whole thing.
Totally.
You know, I'm so curious. It's hard to tell if this is lore or truth, but the narrative goes that Rupert Holmes pitched this show to the producers of Shakespeare in the Park solo, like in a living room somewhere, and like performed the whole thing just for them holding a script.
Right.
Which, like, of course, that's how this sort of thing gets pitched. But even just imagining that experience, you know, of it's not a staged reading, it's not rehearsed. Like, you're just going to describe your show and perform this very complicated, you know, even without some of the audience voting aspects, show. Just in, like, even just performing the inner show, the actual Edwin Drood stuff would is already wildly complicated.
Yeah. And like, then, it kind of works.
Yeah.
Like, in its own right.
Yeah. Like, it could be, you know, save for not having an ending, a mildly interesting Dickensian piece, right?
Yeah. For sure.
But to add on the other layer, you know, the additional layer of the music hall, then layer of the voting, and on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And just to have that from inception, you know, it sounds like it was pitched and then only a couple weeks later it was in production.
Absolutely.
It's wild.
And I guess, like, if you don't really know Drood, or if you don't really know why it's very unique in the music theater sphere, basically Charles Dickens, who wrote the book, died whilst writing it.
Yeah.
And there were no notes or, you know, anything as to what the ending may look like.
Right.
So it was just kind of left as an unfinished piece.
And it's one of the most delightful pieces to be left that way, because it is a mystery, a murder mystery.
Right, exactly.
And so literally there is no ending. And then the show itself frames, like, tells you this. The chairman comes out at the beginning and describes this whole thing to you and then says, "Ladies and gentlemen, by the end of the night, you will decide who did indeed murder Edwin Drood." And the audience votes on that and several other things, and depending upon how they vote, that changes the ending of the show.
Exactly. Every night, many different... I can't remember the exact number of different combinations, but the votes are, you get to vote for who was the, like, secret detective all along, and who was obviously the murderer, and then who are the lovers.
Yep.
So, like, within that, something like 86 or something different combinations that you could possibly get.
Yeah. All with different songs, different, you know, verses, different reactions, and, like, doing their very best to justify why this person you voted for did the thing you voted for them to do.
Exactly. And it all, so it's not just like, this is the murder song. Each person who could have murdered has their own confession.
Yeah.
Whether it makes sense or not, that is interwoven into the story. And it's just, it's really, really smart.
Yeah. And that it, you know, came out of one man's head. I mean,
one man's head.
Certainly in his foreword in one of the published versions of the script, he does talk about having, you know, plenty of inspiration and help. But it was his idea for sure.
Absolutely. And it's something that really hasn't been replicated.
Certainly not in a musical. Like,
I guess, like, we'll talk a bit more about that specific side of it in a bit. But yeah, do you want to talk about a bit more about the different changes between the original and the revival?
It's been really interesting to, like, try and unpack the history of this show. Usually, you know, Jimmy and I will, like, it's really easy to be like, oh, look, what are the new songs added in the contemporary revival? Because they need to give David Hyde Pierce a new song to sing because he's famous and he's going to come out at the beginning of Act Two and sing Penny in My Pocket and be like, okay, David. And because Drood is such a puzzle piecey kind of show, there's, you know, the original show was 3.5 hours long and had 30 something songs, like the original drafts of it, and that have kind of flowed in and out of it. And because it is such a meta theatrical piece, you can kind of just throw it around. Like, it has such a complicated revision journey. It puts it in the same caliber as Meet Me in St. Louis, I would say. But where Meet Me in St. Louis, they were trying to fix the thing. This one is kind of just like, yeah, whatever. Like, even in the current licensable script, there's a ton of optional songs. And like, yeah, you could do this one or not, or put it here. Even beyond the as written, you know, choose your own adventure style ones, but just elsewhere throughout the show. And so, you know, it's really, even just looking at the two very publicly available cast recordings, the 85 one and then the revival 2012-2013 version, there's already tons of differences. And then even on top of that, like, I found myself, you know, reading, like, wait a minute, there's that song, and like Googling and trying to find some amateur high school production, be like, oh my God, it's a whole nother song that I didn't even know you could include in this show.
Like, because the only time I can really think of that happening, certainly in terms of things that I've done, was with Into the Woods.
Yeah,
like, Woods, the licensable Into the Woods has different directions and things like that. But again, not to the point where it like kind of allows you to change the story that you're telling.
Yeah, it is. It does strike, like, I think this is one of Holmes's most canny understandings of theater, is that, and clearly it's reflected in the fabric of this show, but that every night it is different. And to just dive into that, you know, with your entire body. There is the, you know, you read any licensing agreement for a production and it's like, you will change no words in the script and you will adhere to authorial intent and blah, 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 blah. Rupert Holmes wrote like 7 pages of notes at the end of Druid. He's like, you could do this or you could do that, or maybe it's kind of like this. I don't know. Yeah. It's yours. Good luck. And it's such a, I find that such a wholesome understanding of how musical theater is.
Absolutely.
That, like, you can, you have permission to make this one your own, which you don't have if you do even Into the Woods or, you know, Shrek or Mary Poppins, or like those, the authors have decided this is the way it must be. And if you go against that, we have people who will sue you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, so far to say that there is a heavy metal version of Edwin Drood. out there, there was part, I think it was performed in DC.
Oh my God.
There's a video of, I'll just put it in the show notes, of some of the new arrangements that they did. Does it work? It could work.
Yeah.
It could. There's some things that I personally, so for example, like, I think it's the Rosa Budd, still sings in the kind of lyrical operatic style.
Yeah.
Moonfall sounds like a big 80s like Bonnie Tyler style ballad.
Yeah.
Right? And I was like, oh, it'd be so good actually if you just, I mean, to find someone that can like belt high Fs
and just do it like that. Like, yeah.
That's tricky, but that would be really cool.
Yeah.
If you made it have that kind of vibe, like, yeah, that would be epic. But again, just as pure creativity, that's amazing. And there was a really cool interview with Rupert Holmes from like just local press. And he went to go see the show and did a Q&A with them and was like, yeah, I love it. Like, this is, I really like the fact that people go out there and get creative. And he kind of was like, I wish people would do it more.
Like, that's so awesome.
Which I love. I think that's so, like, there's not really any writers who have that level of... it's respect, isn't it? It's respect for the other theater creators out there.
And so many writers, in fact, go so, you know, so hard in the opposite direction. I mean, how many times has Samuel Beckett's estate, like, gone out and sued a college production for doing, like, a female version of Waiting for Godot and changing nothing else? Like, and how... Like, how up your own ass do you have to be to think that you did it perfectly right and no one could possibly have anything at all to possibly add to improve your writing or make commentary on it? Like, of course not. Like, it's so antithetical to what live performance and theater is. I always find it mind-boggling when, you know, the contract is so explicitly written, like, you will do it like this or else. Like, what, you know, that's not the point. That's not why we make theater. It's different every night.
I mean, it just goes to show, like obviously with so many like Broadway revivals and stuff that have changes in them, and
yeah,
you know, it's like, oh, we want to tell this. We look at the Ivan Van Hove West Side Story, right? That's West Side Story. That is,
right,
you know, Jerome Robbins won't let you put a step out of line.
Right.
Obviously, that is different now, but that was held in such high state, and he gets to go in and tear it apart. No high school or college would ever be given that permission, especially with a show that is, you know, contemporarily problematic,
right,
like West Side Story.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, if somebody went in to do, like, with the revival,
yeah,
we're like, oh, we really would love to write some Spanish lyrics for this show. They would have been shat upon.
Yeah, if my high school went and did that, we would get written up, you know. Like, and it does beg the question, why are we doing this then anyway? Like, I do understand as an educator, like, there is certainly some thing to be gained about, like, we're trying to imitate what the real life is, and so we're gonna, you know, do Hairspray, and we're gonna, you know, do our best to make it just like the original thing. And like, as a tech director, as a set designer, I get this all the time. Like, I want it to look like it did on Broadway, right? I want you to build me that. Which has a whole other slew of, you know, copyright problems and intellectual property problems. But like, why not do some new art? Why not build upon the thing? Why not, you know, cultivate and create a neighbor, an environment, a world where that's the standard, not the illegal thing?
Exactly. It is really bad, because like, this is literally a huge creative avenue and an educational environment for the most part,
right?
And you're not allowing people to be creative and learn. Like, it's weird,
right?
It's really, really weird.
And like, I even try to like think through, okay, like what would a well-meaning playwright be worried about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe your work is used to promote something that you disagree with or whatever. Sure, valid. But, like, I've seen plenty of amateur productions of things. I don't think, you know, whatever middle school doing Legally Blonde is, like, doing a super accurate job of recreating the themes and motifs that you very much intended in your Broadway production, right?
Yeah.
Like, so who cares?
Exactly. Well, one of the reasons why, sorry to bring this up, one of the reasons why so many people hate Cats.
Yeah.
Is because they've seen an awful Amdram production of it.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so they're just like, this is trash. And well, actually, if you went to see it in the show theater, you might not have thought that, because it's a huge spectacle. Like, it's not trash.
Right.
But yeah, I am like trying to get high school to do that level of choreography, that level of production value.
Right.
Because that's obviously what they want it to look like.
Right, exactly.
They're never going to achieve that.
No, instead, like, what if you did a, like, let's just, you know, a staged reading of Cats, right? In t-shirts, right? Be an interesting discussion. And
it would be.
And the specter thing, of Lloyd Webber would show up and start throwing tomatoes at you. Like,
he absolutely would. But, yeah. So, yeah, I say, well done, Rupert Holmes.
Yeah. You know,
big fan.
Yeah. More authors should like, be cognizant of that is fucking theater.
It's theater. It's theater.
It's such a stupid thing to say, but you know, having experienced it, you'll be surprised, Jimmy, but I think a lot of theater makers do have their heads up their own asses.
I'm stunned. I'm full stunned. Yeah, no, well done, Mr. Holmes. Good guy.
Shall we talk about what a great job he did with the framing, and you know, get into the actual structure of this giant puzzle bound in
the puzzle
pages?
I love puzzles. Yeah, let's do a puzzle.
All right.
For God's own sake, so raise the stake. You struck a lucky day, never break through any lucky chain or a train. Don't trip by your head, as easily done as sent. You'll see
Glory be. Oh, glory be.
Dost Thou Begin.
Yeah.
Because it's crazy.
The whole, I mean, if Jimmy and I have been trading back and forth trying to find different published versions of this script, because, you know, how on earth from text to stage do you make this thing happen, right?
Exactly.
It's such a mess.
Yeah, because that, like, that's the thing is, like, if you're a script writer, particularly for theater, oftentimes you're so much more prescriptive,
right,
with your language and how you're writing your text.
Yeah.
Whether you go full Arthur Miller and describe,
right,
the smell of the wind.
Yeah, the holy candles on the altar of Laura's face were snuffed out.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Or you can be a bit more free, I guess.
Right.
But with something like this, which is so technically challenging,
yeah,
like just very, very challenging. And as well, like, if you are an amateur company,
yeah,
who isn't maybe not necessarily used to improv,
right,
you need that hand holding, you need that guiding.
Yeah.
And for the most part, certainly, yeah, in the new one, it's there.
Yeah, it does a pretty good job of walking you through, here are the options, here's where you go, here's how to get from this to this, here's what to do when this happens. And it does, you know, one of the delightful things about, I think, the success of framing it in a music hall is like, whatever, you know, like, if, you know, if whoever was like, and the murderer tonight is so-and-so, and that was wrong, like, mm-hmm, they said the wrong word, they'd be like, oh, no, sorry, not you, you, right? It's totally in-world, totally keeps going, could be a joke, like...
Absolutely, like that wouldn't be out of place within the whole context of the show. And I think that's, again, like, that's one of the things that, why I think it's so intelligently written.
Yeah.
Because I don't doubt that that was an intentional framing device. You know,
yeah,
I mean, he didn't have to set it with actors putting on a musical.
Right.
He didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
And that was very much a choice. And it's just served him in so many ways.
Yeah.
But at the same time, throws up a lot more obstacles because you then need to get your audience on side from the get-go.
Right. Yeah, you gotta, you know, let them know what's happening, build it up. And of course they do, like, the construction that, like, you know, you applaud for characters when they arrive on stage, when they're introduced, when they finish their song. It is, I do find it interesting because there are inconsistencies in the world building, and it's interesting, mm-hmm, when you run into those. Like, there is, so for example, the big one, I think, Alice Nutting, the actress who plays Drood, and then, mm-hmm, what's his face? Dick Datchery for the beginning of Act Two,
mm-hmm,
quits in a huff after she's voted to, you know, not be alive anymore, basically. But as an actress, and, like, storms off. It's very funny and definitely plays into Holmes's idea of, like, enjoying when things go wrong. And this is a, yeah, scripted moment of when something goes wrong. But then, also scripted in the show, spoiler alert, is that Edwin Drood is alive, and so this actress who you very visibly watched quit earlier and walks out of, you know, back through the audience, arrives back on stage to reprise her role at the very end. Or even during Both Sides of the Coin, the fact that the chairman is subbing in for whatever, the mayor or whatever character he's supposed to be playing,
mm-hmm,
and is singing this duet with John Jasper, both about how they have this kind of, John Jasper in the show has this split personality thing, whereas the chairman, like, out of the show has this split personality thing.
Yeah.
And not a lot of the other songs are framed as, like, let's just sing this song, save for Bazzard's song. Is that his name? Yeah.
Yes,
But, like, so you start with the chairman doing this accidental substitute in, but then having what has to be a very well-rehearsed song, this,
right,
super high-paced patter song. You know, it is interesting that, like, I very much enjoy that the world has these bounds, and we can play with them, and it doesn't have to be a big deal. No one's standing up in the back and be like, wait a minute, Drood can't be back. You know, mm-hmm, who cares? It's all, who cares?
Exactly. And thank God that she comes back, because she's definitely freaking blocked.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is. Like, I think it's, and it's just quite fun as well, the way that they dance and play in that world. Like, I remember, like, literally splitting up with laughter when they cue off to the races, mm-hmm. just because it's like, it's the song that we always sing in right. every show that we do.
Gotta
and
sing
they
it.
Just cue it by saying like, we must, I guess we better go off to the races.
Might as
oh,
well.
What a fantastic yeah. cue. You know yeah. what I mean? And like, it is really funny. That kind of just self-referential.
Oh, it's so fun. Or way. Like even,
so good.
And I want to talk more about Don't Quit While You're Ahead, maybe in mm-hmm. a minute, but like, the fact that during the encore of Don't Quit While You're Ahead is where, like, the strings fall off the violin, everyone comes to a grinding halt, the chairman takes his hat off and says, ladies and gentlemen, it is at this moment where Charles Dickens laid down his pen for the final time. Like, no, it isn't.
Exactly.
He didn't lay not. Down his pen and he was like, and then during the encore in the kick line, pen right. trails off the page, right?
But it's still just so, it's so great and you're so along for the ride. And I think, like, that is why the voting mm-hmm. works, like, is because they set up all of this silliness and
yeah.
this, like, we're here for you, like, because that's what I think There You Are is such an incredible opening number.
It's so good.
It just, and not even necessarily in terms of content, I think it is really good.
Yeah.
But just in terms of what it is.
Yeah.
And the framing of it. And he talks about this quite a lot, but just how a lot of opening numbers in shows are like, you are here.
Right.
Like, welcome to my world.
Yeah.
Whereas this is very much like, it's like, oh, hello.
Yeah.
Like, thank you for coming. Like, this is such a nice
yeah. and it's all
opening, basically.
It's all like, framed. It's delightful reading the stage directions about it, where it's like, yeah, you know, the house lights don't blink. There's no chime. People just, you know,
absolutely.
The actors start walking in one of the introductions, the whole first stage direction is even written in first person, mm-hmm. which I very much enjoy. Hold on. Let me see if I can find it. Just as we have made some progress with our playbill, and even more successfully progressed through our second glass of hock, we are distracted by a rather beery voice next to us in the aisle. It's Nick Cricker himself. Odd that he would venture out into the audience before the show. He greets us with a few jests that have long lain in the public domain, and is now saying something about or determining the outcome of this evening's performance. Man must be drunk. Voting, he's going on about. And as we try to decipher his words, another voice commences to hawk salutations like a monger of jellied eels. It's Moncrief. Thought the man had more dignity than that. He's addressing another section of the audience, apparently about the same matter that Cricker's going on about. Suddenly a loud cry of Drood emanates from the residents of the cheaper seats. Sounds like Grinstead and his new fellow leading the huzzah. Like, no one writes stage directions like this.
Absolutely. It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. Yeah. But again, it really helps because there's nothing worse. We've all been in that position where it's mm-hmm. like, okay, so you're going to start out in the audience and just
right.
like mingle,
yeah.
just like talk to people, like, you know, have yeah. fun. It's the biggest nightmare, particularly if you are not an improviser.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that is just the worst
yeah.
thing. Yeah. And to kind of give you that slight handhold there of just like, this is the fun that you can
yeah.
have with it.
And this
it,
is what it mean? Should feel like. This is what
exactly.
you... And like, it speaks to Holmes' understanding that like, the show starts the moment you start thinking about the show. And even like, I think the other thing, and this is what I love about Don't Quit While You're Ahead and There You Are, and is, mm-hmm. I can't find the best descriptor for it. I've been trying to talk around this. I made my boyfriend watch some of the clips. And I'm trying to describe this thing I like about it, and I don't have the right words. Maybe you can help me. One of the things I love about There You Are is it is, you know, it's a double entendre, not in a sexual way. It's, you know, Bob's your uncle. There you are, right? It's, you know, this thing happens, that thing happens, and there you are, right? It's just an idiom and a saying of like, and that's what happens. But it is also, as you said, hey, look, you're here in this theater. There you are over there, and there you are over there. And like, that's really... It's funny to me, not haha funny, but like I find it very ticklish.
Yeah, it's tittery.
And then the other one that I love, and I wish, you know, I want Don't Quit While You're Ahead to do it just a little more. They play into it with the encore, but like it starts just with Puffer on stage. And like already the joke is funny because the idiom isn't Don't Quit While You're Ahead. The idiom is Quit While You're Ahead.
Right,
and like
exactly.
it's already framed as like, be an idiot, spend your money, you might win more. But the whole structure, like from the music to the conceit of the song, is like Puffer sings a verse, and then the music goes bum 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 bum, and then two more people walk on stage.
Yeah.
And then they sing a verse, and then they go bum 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 bum, and two more people walk on stage. And like, I wish I don't know. I wish the music just took a little more pause there. Like, it might be done. It might be done. Here's another one. Still
right,
more to do.
I see what you mean.
Right.
Yeah.
And they do that with the encore because, of course, this song needs an encore. This song needs like six encores. You know, don't quit while you're ahead. One more
right,
time.
Absolutely.
And like, it's so funny to me.
Yeah. Again, it feeds into that like silly self-referential nonsense. And I think like it creates like a cool kind of magical chemistry for that show that is then utilized really, really well in the voting because I remember, so obviously from when I saw it,
mm-hmm.
we had what I think must be the most common outcome.
Who won?
Datchery was Bazzard.
Okay.
Because everyone feels sorry for him.
Right. And you want to give him another song.
Exactly. The murderer was Rosa, mm-hmm. because it's kind of the most...
Yeah, which is fun.
It's like the most changing character, do you know what I mean? And then the lovers were the Dantlesses.
Okay.
Because incest.
Right. Of course. Funny. Yeah, that does mean you missed out. I don't know which version it's in, but Bazzard has a line, if he's not Datchery, when he's like pitching himself as a voter.
Uh-huh.
I forget exactly what it is. Because it's all like, why would it be him? He's such a tiny goddamn character. Who cares?
Right, exactly.
Doesn't even do anything. But he goes a little crazy. I says, and who knows? I just might sing again.
it's great.
It's so stupid and so funny.
Yeah. But what I don't know. I'm addicted to the fact that like the actors, like, and the fact that it can change. So like the actors are kind of like selling themselves.
Oh,
do you
yeah
know what I mean, like, it's like, because you know that way in a show, like if you see it say three nights in a row,
mm-hmm.
just depending on the different subtle choices that actor makes,
mm-hmm.
can completely change
That's
the way the audience thinks.
That is the number one thing my mom loves about high school theater. And like any, you know, when I was in stuff, she'd be like, I'm going to come Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And the topic of discussion when I got home, be like, oh my gosh, did you see so-and-so almost tripped? And what a delightful, you know, the thing she loved was the Where's Waldo of it all find the subtle difference.
But I just love the fact though, like, and I don't know if this did happen because I've not heard any of them ever say this, but like, I love the idea that say Bazzard's having an off night,
right?
Or he's like, I can't really be bothered, or like, I'm a bit tired, or I want to get out earlier.
Yeah,
like he then just like holds back a little bit,
right? Doesn't sell himself like, as much.
You know what I mean? Exactly. Yeah. And then, but you know, oh, it's been a while since Jesse Mueller's had a shot, so,
right, so we're,
you know,
gonna go
really
for her
for,
yeah,
exactly. Or just like depending on who's in that night, because I remember Will Chase,
mm-hmm.
Talked about this in an interview where his kids were in,
uh-huh.
and so they've seen it I think like 13 or so times,
uh-huh.
And they've seen lots of different things, but one of the things they never saw, they'd never seen the Reverend do his confession. And so they basically were just like, because they got to help Will Chase
like count
do
the
voting.
Stuff.
And,
yeah.
And so they were just like campaigning with
it.
Like,
right, like,
don't see that.
Number four.
He went on and did it, which is so good, because like, I don't think, I imagine, you know, because that's, I would love to see the stats. Like, I would love to see
I want a bar chart.
But I don't doubt that Chris Parker would be really down the bottom just because he's like, secondary character that isn't necessarily the funniest.
Right, it's not such a funny choice. It's also not a really like convincing choice either.
Yeah, exactly. So I imagine he wouldn't get to do it. So I just love that these kids made that happen and then he got to do it. You know what I mean? It's just there's so much to it.
Yeah.
There's so many ways that it can be pulled. And yeah, just as an actor, as a director, it's just so fun.
It must be
like,
so fun.
Playground.
Yeah. Well, and I do love, and I think maybe the thing we're underselling about this show too is like, for all of its meta theatricality and how much it can like step outside itself and, you know, really mess around and play around with it, it also turns into a serious play every once in a while. Like,
yeah.
You know, in No Good Can Come From Bad is tense. And
absolutely.
You know, Drood's going to get murdered. And so you're like, what? It's the parlor dinner scene. You're watching what's happening and who's doing what. Or like, even how, you know, Beautiful Moonfall is, or even like Perfect Strangers.
So like, yeah.
All of these like in-world play songs. Or the whole like Opium Ballet is just you're sucked into it, and the fact that the show can like, you know, gank you back and forth between these two worlds without you getting too much whiplash is just delightful.
It is, and the fact that it wasn't written by an experienced book writer,
I know,
is like, just delightful. I just think it's incredible.
I mean, I wonder if that's part of it too. And you know, this is always the problem of making overarching assumptions of our admittedly very tiny art form, but like, yeah, being, you know, as Holmes is somewhat of an outsider, you're not stuck in concepts of what musical theater is, right? And so I don't know, it's such, I then go back on that because the whole thing is a love letter to a music hall.
It's a musical, yeah.
Right.
But then it's not, and I think he does know his stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe he's just creative, because he's not come from a theater background. You know, I mean, that wasn't how he started. He didn't set
right.
into the world wanting to be a musical theater composer.
Right.
And maybe just having that weigh in allows you to tackle it a bit differently.
Yeah.
In a similar way that, I guess, like, contemporary example, like, a similar way that Sarah Bareilles came out the score with Waitress. Like, it does have a very fresh sound for the most part.
Yeah.
And that's because she isn't directly embedded in the musical theatre composing scene. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't have that, you know, contemporary Broadway sounds.
It is there. I was, because there's nothing to do these days, and I was watching a whole bunch of you know, YouTube documentary think pieces, as I do, and there's a statement in one of them that I loved about animation. It was some interview with someone who I didn't recognize, so my apologies. The whole thing was about Ratatouille, it was very cool. The framing quote was, "I'm sick of people calling animation a genre. Animation is an art form, but not necessarily a genre. And animation can contain any kind of genre. You can make a Western animation, you can make a soap opera animation, you can make a mystery animation." And I do think, and I think we fall into this trap too, that musical theater is an art form and not a genre, or maybe like straddles it in an interesting way. But
well,
it does.
I think it is, yeah, completely.
It does speak to that. The only reason I hedged that a bit is because this show portrays an English music hall as a genre, not as an art form, you know? And there are parodies of musical theater that do successfully paint it as a genre, not as an art form. Between, you know, well, you pull out the spangles and the kick lines and the top hats, and it becomes a genre again, not an art form. So there's an interesting relationship there that this show and a lot of other shows, but this show especially, plays with and like takes advantage of, how it goes back and forth.
That's an interesting one.
Between genre and art form.
Yeah. That is quite interesting. I guess, like, that almost plays on the, like, when it gets to the genre factor, like, is that genre created out of stereotype?
Right.
You know what I mean? Is that the source of that, or is that literally the the kind of, what do you call that thing that spins? Centrifuged pellet of musical theater.
Exactly. When it is
jazz hands and kick lines.
Exactly. It's the same thing we were kind of talking about in, maybe it was a Strange Loop. It was either Last Time or Joseph. But that this kind of like manufactured nostalgia, know, like this fake nostalgia, and it's all over this show. Like, this is like, no one knows what a music hall is these days.
Right.
You know, no one's been to one. You might have touchstones for it. You might accept it as something as truth, but you don't know that this is what it was like. But this show convinces you that you remember what it was like.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the thing that kind of obviously baffles me, obviously being British, is so much of it is like steeped in like pantomime as well. And just the fact of having like your primary boy, like being
a pants roll,
a female. like, that isn't the core of US theatre. Do you know what I mean? That isn't how US theatre began. That's very much how UK theatre began.
Yeah.
But a US audience looks at that and gets it.
Yeah. And I do think it is because it feels separate. And that does, you know, that's the part that takes you by surprise and kind of opens up that doorway for you to go on that journey tonight. Like, if the show started with, you know, house lights down, drum roll, spotlight up on stage on Chairman, I think it would be less successful. They're not using the entire theater as the setting for the piece. They're falling into our accepted contrivance of the stage and the proscenium and the fourth wall being gone. But because, you know, I'm sitting in the lap of a most engaging chap somewhere in the aisle, now everyone's in on the show.
Exactly.
And is it a show or is it just a game, right? Like, that's the delightful question of the evening. How much of this is planned? Does my vote count? You know, yes.
Yeah, exactly. The answer is yes.
Yeah.
And that's also quite an interesting one because you, like, I could have told you who was going to win that night.
Yeah.
Just based on literally the volume of applause and like who's getting the most laughs, who is, you know what I mean, who is it that night that is kind of winning? And I think that is so cool that it is like it is created by an atmosphere. I think that's good. It's so fun.
This must be such a fun show to be a part of. I think so. In kind of a different tone, but we talk about, you know, those Godspells, those Pippins, the shows where companies become something greater than themselves. And I do think, kind of with a different flavor, but the same idea, this is one of those shows as well, I would imagine.
I wouldn't be surprised either, just because, like, you know that way, like, especially with anything improv'd, the trust that you need
you gotta trust everyone
is so, so strong. So that, just that kind of internal bond that you have to have with every player, I can see that 100% being the case with this one, which is nice, isn't it?
Yeah, it's nice when you find those shows. And it is, you know, I think perhaps as we talked at the very, very beginning, what is delightful about this one is it is so self-indulgent that the question is, where is the upper limit to the self-indulgence? And there might not be one, maybe, but it's way up there, you know, on a show that capitalizes on mugging for the audience. As long as it's funny, you could keep on mugging.
That's it. Keep on mugging. That's the song.
Is it really?
Well, keep on running, keep on trucking.
It's not keep on
keep
mugging.
On
it's not
running.
It's not a recruiting song for miscreants.
No, it's not. But keep on mugging. I don't know. I feel that could be a good YouTube parody.
Isn't that a song cut from Oliver? Keep on mugging. I guess they're pickpockets, not muggers.
Yeah. Cool.
Lances cut like blade through bone, with daggers drawn, I glare at you, there at you. Who dare presume to stare at who might make my wife and share my life? I'd see you dead before sweet rose are wed.
Fleet waits near, I feel it, I fear it. We are friends and yet they'll not soon forget, hearing every threat, every epithet.
In younger days I hungered for another, Rosa's mother. After Rosa's birth, she left this earth. Now dust is all I'm worth.
So long a time they've thought that I'm a Dresden doll, quite naive. But I perceive these boys, this noise, more frightening than they might conceive.
So long a time they've thought that I'm a Dresden doll,
additions, there may be revealed murderous admissions, otherwise concealed. By on you I cast, warning you are hard.
By this lead to us,
no good can come from bad. No good can come from bad.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. Suf's The Original New Musical from Shana Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.
So, hey, it's not perfect.
No.
Well, it's a shame. It's tricky.
It's such a fucking shame.
Yeah, it's disappointing. But yeah. Then also, like, not without hope.
Sure. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So,
Yet hope remains while the company is true.
Yeah.
Lord of the Rings.
Get out of here. Two characters in the show. The characters in the interplay, Helena Landis and Neville Landis, siblings, are from, what's it called?
Ceylon.
Yeah, which is Sri Lanka, which is colonized Sri Lanka. You know, South Indian. And as you would imagine, productions don't have the best track record of dealing with this role.
Mm-hmm.
The 2012-2013 revival put, who was it? Jesse Mueller and Andy Carl in brownface.
Yes.
To the point where even recently when I hadn't been thinking about these things the first time I listened through to the show, and I'm bad with actor names, and I had this thought doing research for this one. I was like, Andy Carl's in this? Who does he play?
Right. Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Which is a bad sign. It's a bad sign.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of, we'll put some links in the show notes, like Roundabout Theater, was called out for this in its own time. I think in a way that would have been bigger news in 2020 than perhaps it was in 2013, which of course speaks to the ongoing blindness and racism problems of Broadway and the theater community at large, for
absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, like, I've seen people make really, really good points that, you know, where these African-American or Afro-Caribbean or just Black characters...
Mm-hmm.
There would be no question that would ever be performed in blackface.
Right, yeah.
So why is it
fine
for it to be done in brownface?
Yeah, and it is, like, it's not wrinkly, but the counter-argument is that this is not a, you know, because of the meta-theatrical nature of this piece, these are performers in a late 1800s music hall performing these roles. And it's frustrating because Holmes writes in, there's a whole page of notes about it in the current script about how this is how it would be performed, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's frustrating because he's not wrong in his historical assessment of this piece.
Yes.
But musical theater, like... We're not aiming for historical accuracy here.
No, not at all. The whole thing is a parody. The whole thing is a melodramatic pastiche
exactly.
of music hall.
Yeah.
That isn't, you know, people aren't in it for the, you know, historical accuracy.
Exactly.
Not at all.
No. In the same way that, like, I think nowadays, to your comparison, you'd have to push pretty hard to argue for a contemporary portrayal of blackface on stage, right?
I mean, it just would never be allowed.
It would never be allowed, even if we're talking about something that is absolutely historically accurate, you
right.
know? And, like,
precisely.
People are so much quicker to be like, oh, yeah, no. So, again, you know, you get the model minority, yellow face, brown face problem of Asian portrayal on Broadway, which we've seen in a bunch of stuff. And I think...
That's it.
You know, you wrote this in, but it's especially disappointing because of the potential power that these roles have in the context of the play.
Absolutely. Like, that's the thing is, out of nowhere. So the song, A British Subject, like, that's why it's so disappointing with the revival, because you can tell it's playing on their mind.
Right.
You can tell they're thinking.
Yeah, because they added, so in the original, they had a song called, I say it wrong, what, Ceylon?
Ceylon.
Ceylon. Just that song. And then they re-added in the song A British Subject for the revival, which was originally part but was not in... did not make the original production.
The original Broadway, yeah. And Ceylon was just more extended and just kind of filled with, let's name places from South Asia.
Right. Oh, how exotic, how different, blah, blah,
right,
blah.
Right, exactly. Whereas what's so disappointing with a British subject is it's like a commentary on colonialism in, you know, the 19th century.
Yeah.
Like it's... which also then has like weird, interesting connotations with immigration nowadays.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like there's these really quite nuanced notes in it.
Yeah.
But it's kind of all thrown to shit when the characters performing it are white.
Right. Yeah. Like you totally shit on your, you know, it's the same problem we kind of get with Millie nowadays. Is like,
yes.
Millie is so close to being this interesting commentary on racism of the time.
Yes.
But it doesn't make it. And
not at all.
Because of the performative nature of this and the way some of this stuff is framed, instead it becomes somehow worse.
Yeah.
Like, and you'd be better off not trying.
Like, yeah, you're going so close. So you're aware. That's that thing. It's like you have the awareness. You know this isn't right.
Right.
So therefore... it's interesting because, like... I've read a few things now, and again, like we'll link a couple of articles and things of people who are South Asian and big music theatre fans, sometimes big fans of Druid itself.
Yeah.
Just talking about the fact, like, you don't need to do it.
Right.
There's nothing in the show. And in fact, even in the script, in the recent producible version of it, they've taken out, like, the one line that Neville Landless says about the colour of his skin.
Right.
To allow you to have white actors being white.
Being white.
That's the circumstances of your, you know,
absolutely.
Casting.
And if we're talking about, like, maintaining historical accuracy, also is an entirely plausible explanation of these two characters in the time that Dickens is writing, right?
Yes.
Like, you're, you know, it's so entrenched in this idea that they can't see the forest for the trees.
Right, exactly. And it's so... nothing would be detracted, for sure, if it was just, you know, another two white characters on stage.
Right.
But also, it would be, in a way, quite good if they gave the opportunity for South Asian actors to play South Asian people.
What a crazy idea. Yeah.
Right, exactly. But also just in a very interesting time when it was to be...
Right.
South Asian,
yeah,
because of colonialism.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
There's no musicals about that,
right?
Certainly.
And it is as a British subject, you know, lays out, like, they're grappling with this stuff in the show, like,
totally.
it's in context,
for
and
sure.
To then blow straight past it when, you know, Holmes is on record saying, like, yeah, it's not Dickens, it's this, whatever, right? Why is this the thing?
Exactly. There's no excuse for it. There just really isn't. And I think, like, the fact is 2012, like, it's crazy that... But then I guess the thing that always baffles me is that, like, well, we just had Aladdin.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Show me all the South Asian actors there.
Exactly. And, like, Aladdin, you know? Especially Disney Aladdin, which is always this, like... weird kind of Middle Eastern Americanized pastiche of this fantasy bullshit. Like, you know, it's already problematic from its inception.
Yeah.
You know, it's frustrating. It's especially frustrating given how much we praise Rupert Holmes at the beginning of this and, like, him being okay with the adaptability and the flexibility of some of this. Like,
yeah.
But then this is the one that stuck around. Like,
yeah, I find it quite interesting. Like, obviously, we don't know the conversations that happen behind closed doors.
Of course.
You know, he didn't cast it.
Right. Yeah.
And he didn't direct it.
Yeah.
Was it the fact that, you know, the director was like, no, this is how I want this to be done because X? Or was it like, you know, we need big names. Jesse Mueller, very up and coming. Andy Carl, very, very up and coming.
Yeah.
You know, like... let's get these guys in as our supporting roles.
Right.
That would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, sure, because I don't think there's a South Asian equivalent.
Right.
right? Yeah.
Not in a casting director's mind at the time, certainly.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. So I can see that being the thing, but it's a shame that I've never seen him talk about it as a problem.
Yeah, that's the frustrating thing. And I do think, you know, in this, as we enter a post-George Floyd era, the theater community does seem very much to be moving towards a if you see something, say something model,
very much so.
Which is much better than it's been. Because certainly, you know, inter-producer casting politics, like, there's a world where there might have been plenty of people who saw problems with this who didn't speak up for fear of their careers or whatever. And, you know, we're now landing on a place where, like, that's not an acceptable place to be in anymore.
Which
is a great sign of the times. It is frustrating to see, you know what, this was 7 years ago, not that long ago.
Right, exactly. And Aladdin was even closer than that. So, the next production of Druid that comes on.
Yeah. You know, if you're doing it in your high school, like, I think, I don't know, I guess I wonder what your opinion on this is. And it's because it's so mired in a history. Like, I have changed my opinion on all white schools producing Once on This Island in the past couple months. I don't think they should anymore. Which I would have argued the exact opposite and very well may have in the past. This one is, I don't know, I'm more curious about it too, because it's a popular high school show, for sure. And high school theater departments, you know, for worse, absolutely run white, which is a huge problem in this country.
Well, it's interesting, because I was quite fortunate in my high school that it was very diverse, very multicultural, and even within our theater department as well, which is good. I don't think that our director would have ever put white people in brownface,
right?
Because we have plenty of actors of Asian descent.
You've got a casting pool, yeah.
Right, exactly. And that it would be ridiculous. Like, that would be ridiculous. That would be flat out offensive, because you've got, you know, I mean, it's that thing. It's like, well, you've got people there.
Yeah.
Why aren't you putting them in the spotlight?
I think that the scenario I want to present, because this is a show where you could conceivably have both options, right? You cast white characters in this role, and with the appropriate sensitivity, probably be just fine. Because of the landscape of, you know, high school and amateur theater and casting pools and things like that, you know, picture this. You want to do Edwin Drood. You've got two appropriately castable South Asian actors who are auditioning, right?
Yeah.
Are you pre-casting them in these roles, or could you make one of them Jasper, right? And the obvious right correct answer is yes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But I see so many, I see this all the time in, you know, my peers who I know work in high schools and my experience with high school theater across the country. Like, I saw high school do Millie because they knew they had two vaguely Asian characters who could play the two Asian characters.
Yeah.
And like, it's tokenizing. It is, you know, somewhat dehumanizing. It perpetuates the continual problem with these things. You know,
and I don't doubt that it's so frustrating for the kids.
Yeah. Like, I'm going to play the Asian character. God damn it. Right. You know, why can't I play the other role? You know, like, I don't see, and maybe I'm not looking in the right places, but, like, I don't know where else to look. Every high school that's not happening right now is doing some diversity and inclusion Zoom workshop right now. And these aren't conversations that are happening,
which is
frustrating because it's the national discourse right now.
Absolutely.
And, like, we got to look at it.
It's such a gift that amateur groups have. And that they don't need to work with casting directors who are thinking about clout.
Right.
I think it's like Lin-Manuel goes on record a lot saying, like, where in the world could, like, a young, skinny Latin American boy play Tevye?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that's the joy of having these opportunities when you're in
yeah.
high school or yeah. amateur dramatic yeah. companies.
But flipped on its head, we still find problems. I mean, the contemporary Hairspray drama of the script previously having provisions in it for non-black yes. actors to portray the black characters and just got removed because that's hugely problematic.
Of course it is.
You know, this is, it's a minefield. Yeah. And I'm happy that I think everyone's reckoning with it now. I'm sad that it, you know, I remember feeling uncomfortable when I student taught and they cast the two Asian kids in Millie.
Right.
But I'm not going to speak up to my cooperating teacher, right?
Exactly. Yeah. You have to be complicit in these things, isn't it? You know, the same way that, I don't doubt there were people in that cast who did not feel comfortable.
Right.
You know what I mean? They wouldn't say, well, they might say, I don't know, against it, but how comfortable would Jason Mueller feel putting on a really thick, indeterminate South Asian accent?
I know. And like, at what point should Jesse Mueller say no?
Precisely. Because right. she wasn't Jesse Mueller at that point.
Right, exactly.
Do you know what I mean? Beautiful hadn't happened.
Yep. Yeah.
And I'm not saying like, so, you know, Jesse, like, therefore she's a demon and she sold out. Like, right. absolutely not. But I guess it just shows you, like, I can't see her standing by that happening now.
Right. And it's how much of a reckoning, it's how deep this shit goes, right?
Yeah.
And how ingrained it all is, all the yeah. way back to Charles Dickens, right? And
right.
the show shows that. And why it, you know, it is a huge unpacking. And like, as much as we do couch these things in like, well, there's systems in place that are holding people down then, and like, maybe, but these days mm-hmm. that's a bullshit excuse. If you see something, mm-hmm. say something, right?
Exactly.
And, you know, I don't think, like, I haven't done a granular search of Jesse or Andy's Twitter yet, but it's the sort of thing where, yeah, maybe you should say something nowadays.
Yeah.
Like, we are all atoning for our sins.
Exactly.
And it's signs of growth, and, you know, everyone should. Mm-hmm. Really. I honestly
for sure.
believe that.
For sure. What I will say, though, that revival cast was sensational.
I know. It's the frustrating thing about it is they did a really good job.
getting to see Cheetah Rivera perform on the stage.
I'm sure.
Is like a box ticked.
Yeah.
Also, so yeah, she was 80 and she was doing higher kicks than anyone else on the stage.
Of course.
Just like, you're the best person. Because also, I have to commend her British accent.
Mm.
It's very good.
Yeah.
That is good Cockney. Like, it wasn't overplayed.
I wondered what you thought about as you know, a Brit watching Americans do British, how overall, because we've talked about this before, how sometimes it's really shitty.
Yes, Billy Elliot. Yeah, some a lot of time it's really, really bad.
Yeah.
Just get Cheetah Rivera to do it, mate. I was really impressed. I was honestly really, really impressed. No, they all did. I mean, the thing is, it's like, I feel like the RP English mm-hmm. is a lot easier to do
yeah.
than Cockney, just because Cockney's feel of so much nuance.
Sure.
So, yeah, that's why I was just so impressed with her specifically.
Yeah.
It was great. Great performance.
Yeah.
So good. So yeah. many good performances. Stephanie J. Block.
Oh, so delightful. Yeah, let's do some Stephanie J. talk.
Yeah, exactly. We'll get a sting.
I mean, I do think the thing that is just delightful about this show is because it is so bawdy, because it is so indulgent, mm-hmm. you could get these great performers in it and they could do a more than halfway decent job at baseline.
Mm-hmm.
And the 2012 production is delightful. Like, no one is at their baseline. It is filled to the brim with subtlety and nuance, and that just creates, I imagine, for a rip-roaring night.
Oh, it was so fun. Like, it just had the best time. Like,
yeah.
it was, yeah, kind of surprisingly so, because I remember going in And obviously having only listened to it once.
Sure.
And I think if you just listen through it, not really understanding the voting side of it and how that all works.
Yeah.
It's not the most impressive. You're not like, wow, this musical
right.
is
Right. Well, and even, it. You know, we haven't even gone into the plot of actual Edwin Drood, which is so complicated, it's like barely worth talking about. Right,
right, exactly, exactly. And a lot of the times, like, although the songs are driving the plot, they're not like plot filled, if that makes sense.
Right.
Like a lot of it is contained just in the book itself.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's, I think it exists so much in that night. Like, I don't know. It was just such a great time. Out of interest, do you know Jim Norton, who he plays the mayor, the German?
Not offhand, no. Who is he?
So he is like, it was so funny because I remember watching it and just being like, I know exactly who you are. Who are you? You know what I mean?
Right.
Watch it. So he, for the Brits listening, played Bishop Brennan in a sitcom over here called Father Ted.
Oh, I know Father Ted. Okay.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, just as a cultural touchstone, not deeply.
Right, okay. I mean, definitely get it watched because it's seminal comedy, like, absolutely. Particularly with a Catholic upbringing. So you'll have many things to think about. But yeah, so he plays this guy, and I was like, oh my gosh. And he's a very, very good actor, like, and has done quite a lot of other stuff in certainly British theatre, British TV. But yeah, just even down to that, I was like, that is crazy that you're there. And then so is Will Chase. Mm-hmm. And so is definitely, you know what I mean? Like, right. It's just a medley.
Just an all-star
vegetable
cast.
Medley.
Yeah.
Of joy. Yeah. And I feel very lucky that I got to see it.
Yeah. It does sound delightful. Well, and it is even, you know, re-listening to it a bunch recently, this thing we've described as being like very fluffy and very inconsequential in its conceit. But I was, I was making my way through it maybe for the last time last night. And so much of this show is witty wordplay and not much more. But listening to Writing on the Wall for the last time, like there's a beautiful part and Stephanie J. Block delivers it wonderfully. Like, if you hear my voice, then you're alive. What a bloody marvel we survive when you think of every risk we face in our mad human race. Is like one. I'm finding more of these lyrics and the things I enjoy that like 2 years ago would be like, huh, what a fluffy idiom about how happy life is.
Yeah.
And nowadays I'm like, yeah, wow, it is wild that like we're still alive.
Exactly. And especially with Stephanie J. Block and Beldy Brogue behind it.
Oh, you know, yeah. I mean, you know, what do the
you
kids
feel it.
What do the kids say? Like, it hits different now.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, that, like, I think the Writing on the Wall, the finale version, is a really good, like, show tune.
Yeah.
It's really, really good. And it's even, like, when the chorus creep in with the ooze and the build-up.
Yeah.
Right to that final note. Just
it's so good in a show that could have just sung Off to the Races again and it would have been hilarious and appropriate and done right, which they do after Bows, but like they could have just end with like, we figured it out, a 1 2 3 off to the right, they could have but instead we get this, you know, wonderful anthem of a march about like how delightful it is to be alive, and we've left Dickens so far behind.
Yeah, exactly. So that song ain't going anywhere. Hopefully the racism does in any future productions.
Yeah. Write to Concord Theatricals or whoever is your local Amdram and say they need to revise their script, you know.
Exactly. Just say don't do it.
Yeah, get Holmes back on the phone again and be like, "Hey, okay. We did the wrong. Time to do the right now."
Exactly.
Let's fix it.
Exactly. Because it's a good show and it's a show that should be performed.
Yeah,
I think
it is. I do find as we enter our reproblematizing of everything that's ever been written, you know, what are we canceling? What are we not canceling?
Right.
Like, I do think it is worth it to look in things and be like, what is, you know, don't frame it as what are we canceling, but like, what's salvageable? What can we, you know, what can go past this moment alongside all the new stuff we should be making?
And for sure, exactly.
I would argue
that we should be elevating.
Right, exactly. I would argue that Drood can let's keep it going. Let's find a way to to fix this and still honor what it is.
Is
it clear? If you hear my voice, then you're alive. What a bloody marvel we survive. When you think of every risk we face in our mad human race, I have read the writing on the wall. Try to live forever and give up never. The fight, you'll need the wherewithal. Can't you hear
the
lightning as I plead?
That was Jimmy, the mystery of Edwin Drood. Why do they gavel? I never understood. And they don't do it on the recording.
I mean,
is that a music
British.
Hall thing?
It's British. Yeah, yeah. It's British. Actually, it probably is.
Yeah.
That's not something you just do.
But it could be. That's the thing about this musical. I totally believe.
It feels you know, like the philistry in Midsummer Night's Dream. I feel like that's something he would do.
Yeah.
Right?
Perhaps.
That's a reference. hey, philistrates aside, wanna know what's next?
I'm so excited to hear your quiz question. But first let me take a philistrates aside as I talk Sorry, it was bad.
Oh, I see what you were doing.
Yeah, there. I shouldn't have pursued that joke. It wasn't. It was a bad bit.
That was a Shakespeare joke. Shakespeare joke that you were just making there.
Thank you. As we dissect this frog,
I'll carry on with the quiz question there, shall I? Okay. So, hey, Chance the Rapper recently saw inspiration from perhaps one of the most unlikely of places. And that was one of the songs in this Golden Age musical. What musical is that?
Chance the Rapper's from Chicago. And for a while, there was a crocodile or an alligator. I always get them confused in one of the manufactured lakes in one of the parks of Chicago. And informally, the alligator was named Chance the Snapper.
That's cute.
If you want to get in touch with the show, our Twitter and Instagram is at Jim and Tomic, JimandTomic. Or you can drop us an email at jimandtomic@gmail.com or on our website, jimandtomic.com.
And hey, while you're over there, you can have a gander at our Patreon if you would like to financially support the show. All of our current patrons, we love you. We've had a few more come through the doors recently, and we love you deeply. And dearly. But hey, if you want to just support us in any way, reviews over on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen are super duper helpful.
Absolutely, tell your friends. Jimmy, I actually got a Facebook message from an old college acquaintance who was like, oh, stumbling through podcasts, found your podcast. Very sweet. Hi, Matt. Thanks for listening.
I love that.
Isn't that delightful?
I love that a lot. That could be you, ladies and gentlemen.
That could be you. Well, not you, because you're listening already. Unless you're listening exactly, because someone told you. How does this time? Is it an illusion?
Well, in which case, that is you.
That's true. Hey, you, thanks for listening.
Yeah, specifically you. Thank you for listening. And hey, Tommy, specifically you. Cheers.
Cheers, Jimmy.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway,
Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.
So you're sick with big lightitis, is what you're saying?
Big lightitis, yeah. Big lightitis sounds like it can be too bad.